Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. This is going to be an empowering hour. You can watch this program by going to Ustream channel and looking for Gary Null. We're going to talk about health and nutrition as we do with every program. Vitamin C halts an aggressive form of colorectal cancer in preclinical study. That's good. And of course, that's always from peer-reviewed journals. This is from the Cornell University Medical Center. And how diet can determine your risks of rheumatoid arthritis. Harvard Medical School. I've got a little anecdotal story where Barry Farber was going to host a debate between the respected Harvard professor Frederick Stare and myself on the subject of arthritis. Stare didn't show up, and it was about arthritis and diet. I'll show you the irony. Then also from Harvard School of Public Health today, eating more homemade meals can reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes. Yeah, we're eating out more than we're eating in. And also, chondroitin outperforms celecoxib in knee osteoarthritis study. This is the University of Montreal. So a chemical touted by your rheumatologist and others and your physician, better. No, the actual science shows a natural nutrient with no side effects, but healing effects is better. And a lot more on health and healing. Then, with the presidential debate, I'm going to give some headlines of stories that we cover here at the Progressive Radio Network and on our sister stations that will not be mentioned at all, but are very important. And it's amazing what they will talk about and what they won't talk about. But also, I'm going to play some of the best clips that we came put together from Martin Luther King. Not just his Riverside Church, but a lot that is really relevant today. In fact, if these were given today, they would be absolutely as timely as they were when they were given. Also, most of the candidates running believe that in creationism, and they reject any other concept. We'll challenge that on today's program. Then we have our guest. And I'm setting aside extra time for my guest today because this is a Conversations with Remarkable Minds. Dr. Fritjof Capra. Many people know him because he is the mind behind the Tao of Physics, one of the most important books of the 1970s, to introduce the properties of physics and its synergy with spiritual insights and the teachings of Eastern mysticism. For the past 40 years, he's been researching the shift of worldviews and paradigms, and how this might lead to a new vision of reality that would bring forth a cultural transformation. So, from Berkeley, we'll be talking with him about understanding and adapting a systems view of life to better comprehend our world and civilization. Let's begin. Chondroitin sulfate and glucosamine sulfate and sea cucumber and quercetin and black cumin seed oil and coconut oil, that is a great remedy for osteoarthritis. This is from the University of Montreal, and this was presented at the American College of Rheumatology's annual meeting in San Francisco. Quote, for the first time, chondroitin sulfate has been more successful, I repeat, more successful than the primary drug used in reducing the long-term progression of knee osteoarthritis. Now, our osteoarthritis is no simple matter. It slowly and progressively breaks down the joint cartilage, in which case you almost always have to have some form of surgery. And normally, cartilage on the ends of the bones allows smooth, pain-free joint movement. In osteoarthritis, cartilage becomes thin and irregular, resulting in symptoms of joint pain and stiffness. And that grinding or cracking sensation can occur. and joints that are under high stress due to, let's say, weight bearing, you're overweight or you're exercising, then it's going to be really exacerbating that. The hips, the knees, and the hands and the spines are commonly affected. And the older you get, the more common it is. Now, chondroitin sulfate, or more commonly called chondroitin, has long been the subject of discussion in those of us who read the scientific literature and compare it. Now, this was compared to Celebrex. And Celebrex has some very serious toxic side effects. So they compared the two in the best study ever done on it. And this is a whole group of investigators. There was University of Montreal, there was the School of Medicine and the hospital, and they took these individuals in this study, and they all had similar situations, and they gave them either 1,200 milligrams of the chondroitin daily, or 200 milligrams of Celebrex daily. And then they watched them over a period of time, did the measurements. Well, chondroitin won. So there's an example of how everyone, holistic physicians, nurses, nutritionists, and dietitians, those of us who've been advocating chondroitin for the last 30 years, we were right. And all of the rheumatologists, all of the physicians, you were wrong that whole time. And those who are the quackbusters, they're wrong about everything all the time. But this should be the final nail in their coffin of any credibility. So all the nutritionists, just remember, their literature before their body, their most distinguished body, and in a peer-reviewed journal showed a natural substance beat the drug. Now, let's go a little further with this. This is a study on diet from Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And this was presented also two studies at the American College of Rheumatology's national meeting. So this is where the best and brightest, the whole field, get together. These are all rheumatologists. Most are board certified. And what they found was this. I'll quote directly. Rheumatoid arthritis is the most common chronic autoimmune disease that affects the joints. Rheumatoid arthritis has the potential for joint damage and deformity with loss of function. The cause of rheumatoid arthritis is unknown. It affects people of all ages, and women are more commonly affected than men. It causes pain, stiffness, and swelling, generally in multiple joints. The first study found that typical Western diets, high in red meat, processed meat, refined grains, fried food, high-fat dairy, and sweets can increase a person's risk of developing rheumatoid arthritis in comparison to prudent diets made mostly of fruits, vegetables, legumes, whole grains, poultry, and fish. Well, how about that? Let me repeat that. The first study found that diets high in red meat, processed meat, refined grains, fried foods, high-fat dairy, and sweets can increase a person's risk of developing rheumatoid arthritis. Quote, the evidence for diet having a role in the etiology of rheumatoid arthritis is inconsistent, sometimes conflicting. The prior studies based on individual nutrients and food groups may not have had enough power to detect small effects. This one, however, instead, overall dietary patterns analyzed, examines the cumulative effects of multiple nutrients and found in foods and may be more predictive of disease risk than individual foods or nutrients. So, there was 116,460 nurses in this study from 25 to 42. And they followed these women for 4 years. And they followed them for 12 years. And then they every 4 years, they would do a review. Now, why is this important? Because it was back in 1977 on my radio program that I was challenged by a rheumatologist saying there was no connection between diet, either what you took or did not take, or beverages and rheumatoid arthritis, either in causing it or relieving any pain. In fact, that was the official position of all rheumatologists and their official association, the one I just mentioned, just had his convention, just had two articles showing the connection. So there was a debate planned, and the rheumatologist came on the program, and I laid out my arguments about a group of individuals who I had been following, who had put on a healthy program, and those who had rheumatoid arthritis. Over 90% did not have any symptoms of rheumatoid arthritis after 3 months on the program. And it was the same program I'm still using today. The elimination of all processed foods, any highly acidic foods, caffeine, sugar, artificial sweeteners, carbonated beverages, all animal proteins. It was a strictly healthy organic vegan diet with lots of juices and nutrients. So I presented mine, and he said, but there is no proof. And yet when I asked him, you say there's no proof. What proof do you have that there is no proof? And the idea was that we should believe him because he is a board-certified rheumatologist and because all the literature put out by the American Rheumatology Association shows that. So I said, so there is no science. He said, what do you mean? And I said, well, if you believe in science, as I do, then you believe that science is, should be able to deconstruct its own myths, its own facades. It should be able to challenge itself. And we disagreed. He didn't believe that. Jump ahead a few months. There was to be a debate on the incidence of hyperactivity in children, food additives in cereals, sugar in cereals, refined carbohydrate impacting children's brain and blood sugar. And the moderator was to be Barry Farber. I was to represent one side of the issue and Frederick Stare of Harvard the other side. He was known as the Cornflakes Professor because his department at Harvard was substantially subsidized from General Mills and sugar-consuming or sugar-embedded products. So anyhow, we were there, ready to go, airtime, live. He didn't show. And we got word finally about 15 minutes in that he couldn't be bothered. He was out playing tennis. All right, fine. Virtually everything that the pro-sugar professors have been stating has now been shown to be completely wrong. But here's the issue. What does it tell us when the only truth is an official truth? And anyone who challenges official truth is excluded. So the only people in the debate on are the Democrats and Republicans. But if Jill Stein were invited, if the Justice Department, the justice groups were invited, and others, there'd be multiple views that we could select from, as you have multiple parties in different parliaments around the world. You don't have in the United States. You have the Democrat or Republican. And swinging in a pendulum, but you're still a Democrat. Bernie Sanders is still very pro-war, very pro-armaments, very pro-Saudi Arabia, without question, one of the worst regimes in the world, and the primary sponsor of all terrorism in the world today. They fund it. They train them. They're behind ISIS. They're behind all this. And yet, he wants to do business with them. Why? Because they buy a lot of stuff. So why should he be allowed to represent Democrats? Oh, I forgot, because only corporate Democrats today are representing Democrats. People who are true Democrats or true liberals, they're not invited. They're excluded. You are attacked. You're put upon. And one day you find you don't have a base. As a country, what does that say about we the people, not the politicians? Understand the people running for office frequently are very insecure people. They need to have control over other people and their decisions. Fine. What about us? What does it say when we actually listen to them, believe in them, and support them? We are the ones who should be on the couch being analyzed, not them. They're clear, patented, monikered sociopaths. All of them. So, it's, my God, it's, I've said it before, I'll say it again. Voting for any of these people, any of them, is like trying to find a drink of clean water in a filled toilet bowl. Good luck with that. and yet there'll be people who will be out there apple bobbing trying to do it. Vitamin C. And by the way, isn't it interesting that no one from the entire medical industrial complex will ever acknowledge that we have been right on every single health issue in the last 40 years, and they've been wrong on every single issue. But that's the nature of power. You fail up instead of out. Now think about that in every way of life. From the Cornell University Medical School, we have a good article published in the peer-reviewed journal Science on vitamin C. Quote, I'll quote it verbatim. High levels of vitamin C kill certain kinds of colorectal cancers in cell culture in mice, according to a new study. And colorectal cancer is the third most common cancer diagnosed in the United States, with about 93,000 new cases each year. Around half of those cancers harbor mutations in the KRAS and the BRAF genes. These form the disease, and it becomes more aggressive. It doesn't respond well to traditional therapy or chemotherapy. In this study, published in the current issue of Science, the individuals use vitamin C, and, quote, our findings provide a mechanistic rationale for exploring the therapeutic use of vitamin C to treat colorectal cancers that carry the KRAS and BRAF mutations, said the lead author of this study. Well, in an oxygen-rich environment, such as human arteries, a fraction of vitamin C, also called ascorbic acid, becomes oxidized and is transformed into a new compound called DHA. And scientists have known for some time that a specific membrane protein known as glucose transporter GLUT1 enables both glucose and DHA to enter cells, an activity not offered to ascorbic acid. But it was less clear what DHA does once inside the cells. In this study, investigators showed that DHA acts like a Trojan horse. Once inside, natural antioxidants inside the cancer cell attempt to convert the DHA back to ascorbic acid. In the process, these antioxidants are depleted and the cell dies from oxidative stress. Well, and that's, mind you, that's mainstream science in a mainstream journal acknowledging what Linus Pauling, Albert Sinjori, Georgie, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering, who I interviewed, who discovered ascorbic acid, Dr. Stone, who was the advocate who got Pauling interested in vitamin C, and we at the Tri-State Healing Center, over 20 healthcare professional medical doctors, we work with thousands upon thousands of patients, and the primary therapy was high levels of vitamin C intravenous with other nutrients, including aqua vitamin A base. And then outside the body, there was all forms of herbs, botanicals, homeopaths, juicing. And we had the best statistics for recovering people with full-blown AIDS and cancers. And these were almost all end-stage cancers when they came. And it was open to the public. Any doctor, any scientist could come in. They could talk with anyone, talk with the medical staff. And more than half of all patients were treated for free. So it shows that it wasn't just a theoretical, or it was evidence-based. Now they're discovering what we were doing 30 years ago. Now it's still a long way from them discovering this to doctors implementing it, because standing between your doctor using vitamin C, because if it work on colorectal cells, it'll work on any cancer cell in the body, because we had success with every cancer in the body. But between that information on how a natural, non-toxic substance can help your immune system in a unique way kill cancer cells or help you recover your health from full-blown AIDS, which we did, 12 people I worked with, all 12 reversed their AIDS. And that was a matter of scientific fact. We had independent medical evaluations, all the medical tests, and of course, wonder how that was received by ACT UP and other groups that were aligning themselves, at least that faction that aligned themselves with the pharmaceutical industry. Wonder how that went down with all those organizations out there that were getting millions of dollars a year by showing up promoting AZT and other toxic drugs and causing the death of hundreds of thousands of people. Wonder how the idea that there is a natural non-toxic protocol that could get a person back on their feet rather than putting them in a grave. Wonder how that worked out. Well, that's the politics. That's why you'll never see a natural therapy for cancer advocated, because the chemotherapy is just hundreds of billions of dollars for the industry and hundreds of millions of dollars for the oncologists who can buy it and wholesale and sell it at retail per patient without ever informing the patient, hey, you know, $13,000 chemotherapy pill I just gave you or injection, I make $7,000 off you, and I got 100 of you, or I got 200 of you, or I got 300. So this is going to be a good year. You and your treatment are going to pay for my daughter, my son's education at Harvard or Yale to follow in my footsteps. It'll pay for a new and that and five more. Do you ever hear that conversation? Ever? Do you ever hear the conversation when the doctor calls and say, I work with your husband, I work with your wife, I work with your son and daughter, whoever it was, and we did the best we could, we failed, they died. They trusted 100%. They never wavered. They never took that stupid quackery juices and that supercilious medical doctor who nobody believes in who was talking about cleansing and rebuilding the immune system. No, they didn't venture off the path one step. But we failed. Therefore, I don't feel it's right for me to profit when I fail. And by the way, we fail almost all the time with end-stage cancers. And so we're not going to charge when we fail. Did you ever hear that conversation? Has anyone in the America ever had that conversation? If you have, let me know. Eating more homemade meals may reduce the risk of type 2 diabetes. This is from Harvard School of Public Health. Here's what it says. They examined 58,000 women, 41,000 men, and they looked at people who did not have diabetes, cardiovascular disease, or cancer at the beginning of a study. And then they looked at them over a period of years when they started eating either at home or out. And they found a substantial difference when they ate at home. Quote, if you eat, and this is from Harvard, quote, if you eat more meals prepared at home, you may reduce your risk of developing type 2 diabetes. And people who ate about two homemade lunches or dinners each day or about 11 to 14 meals a week had a 13% lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes compared to people who ate less than six homemade lunches or dinners a week. Okay, now, here's the deal. That was a typical study out of Harvard. I would suggest doing it again. But this time, why don't you have a group of people who, when they do eat out, they eat only vegan, healthy, organic meals and compare those to those who eat the normal American diet in most restaurants. Now, you can eat a $30 meal, a big steak in a fancy restaurant, or you can eat the same amount of meat in the form of hamburgers or in a fast food restaurant, but you're still eating processed meats versus vegan. So you see, if you came to me as a student, I would reject this because you didn't do your homework. You didn't compare a healthy meal out. And what if you ate an unhealthy meal at home? A lot of people, do you think if you go into people's homes and you look in their cupboards and their refrigerators, you're going to see all healthy items? No. So you have to look at people eating healthy at home versus unhealthy at home, healthy outside versus unhealthy outside. So Harvard School of Public Health, you fail. A big F. I forgot. You're Harvard. You can't fail. You have all these spoiled dilettantes running around as professors, administrators. Larry Summers, wasn't he the misogynist guy who used to run your little crappy school? I think so. My God, where we look for the truth. And these people just don't have the intellect to put it together or the desire. when meat consumption, especially when cooked at high temperatures, linked to elevated kidney cancer risk. Oh, hold on a second. That's all fast foods. That's every grill in America. Quote, University of Texas, diets high in meat may lead to an increased risk of developing renal cell carcinoma through intake of carcinogenic compounds created by certain cooking techniques, such as barbecuing and pan frying or grilling. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cancer. All right, that's good. Good research here. Because renal cell carcinoma, the most common form of kidney cancer, it'll be diagnosed 60,000 times this year, and it'll kill 14,000 people. But why not have a press conference and show the impact of all the meat that is grilled or fried in fast food restaurants? Because that's where most Americans consume their meat, and that's how they consume it. So if you want to make an impact, you know, of the people reading Cancer, those are primarily physicians or researchers. That's fine. But it's not getting that message out to the American public. If you did a 60-second PSA, public service announcement, where you showed people, just like what they do with tobacco, but show people eating those, you know, hamburgers and hot dogs and all the other things that are you eating out, and then show the increased risk of this cancer and show someone with cancer, you could make an impact. Just a thought. That's the latest on Health and Healing. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. In about 8 minutes, we're going to be listening to Dr. Fritjof Capra in our Conversations with Remarkable Minds, talking about understanding and adapting a systems view of life to better comprehend our world and civilization. And before that, we're going to hear from bits and pieces of some of the most memorable comments from Dr. Martin Luther King, who I believe that we could benefit from listening, interpreting correctly in the right context, and then applying these principles today. But first, we have Luann Panessi on the line. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have one quick announcement and one quick question for you.
All right.
The announcement is this. We are still interviewing for people who are interested in working at a homestead. Now, the homestead is not going to be in the New York area, and it's going to be for a two-week period. And if people are interested, if they have experience with working with things like greenhouses and sprouting and hydroponics and things like that, you can give me a call. My number here is 631-504-6198. That's 631-504-6198. And I've been interviewing people for the last few days, and I have a few more openings.
Good. This is a free program for people who want to change their lives and get off the grid. It's a public service to help people. Thank you, Luann.
Okay.
And what's your question?
The question is this. I've had many people and ask me, they listen to you, and they have a lot of your DVDs, but over time, they're not really committed or they haven't had the self-discipline to actually follow a program. And now all of a sudden, they're getting chronic illnesses. They may get cancer, heart disease, diabetes, arthritis. And they have asked me, even though I've been not really adhering to the program, is it too late for me to start?
No, it is not. There's good news. I've seen people who are in their 90s begin to make changes and see some improvements. But it depends upon how much damage was done prior to them making their change and how committed they are to that change. Most people don't commit themselves completely to anything unless there is a crisis that requires it, demands it. It's when the doctor says, look, you can't smoke anymore, you have lung cancer. And the person then has to decide, I still have the urge to smoke, I still want to smoke. Do I smoke knowing I could die of lung cancer? And some people still do. My own brother did. And so I know that I know how that manifests in people's minds. On the other end of that, you'll find people who will say, okay, I wasn't paying attention before to cause and effect. I somehow thought that the idea of karma was just a myth, some supercilious urban slogan that hippies used, but it has no meaning. No, karma is simply cause and effect. That's all it is. That here's what we don't know. We don't know when something's going to tip. We don't know when the heart attack or stroke will come, or the cancer will come, or the dementia will come, or Alzheimer's, or arthritis. But if you continue to assault the senses and the body, when you continue to drink or smoke or eat fried foods or be lazy and not exercise, then it is going to come. It's just no one knows when. So if the only time you're willing to make any adjustments in your life is after you have been impacted in a negative way with an incident, then the question is, do you just want to get back to where you're no longer in pain or suffering, or do you want to transform your life? Now, the good news is I've seen people completely transform their life, but you can't transform your life to transform your perceptions about your life and what you no longer want to honor, what you no longer want to hear or be or see or feel. So once you come to that point in your life where you say, I want to do it all over again and do it right to who I authentically am, honor my actual life, then I've seen major improvements, a whole new life rebuilt from what someone would have thought was impossible, but it's not. It only becomes problematic when you only want to change to the degree of limiting your suffering but not do anything more than that. Then you might see some improvement, but you're not going to see a transformation. Transformation doesn't come through maladaptive behavior. It comes through allowing yourself to honor your spiritual self and grow. And that's what we need. We need a renaissance in spiritual growth in our country, having nothing directly to do with religion, but everything to do with the ethics of life. Hope that answers your question.
Sure does. Thank you.
Okay. Let's go over now and say hello to Dr. Fritjof Capra. He's in Berkeley, California. He's a physicist and system theorist, an educator, an activist, an author of many international best-selling works dealing with emerging scientific principles that can alter our inadequate and dysfunctional worldviews and the ethics of society, which many people in this audience have said, can we deal more with this? And I'm saying yes, and here he is to deal with it. He is a fellow at the Shoemaker College in the United Kingdom, serves on the Council of the Earth Charter Initiative, holds degrees in theoretical physics from the University of Vienna, and has worked on high-energy physics at the University of Paris, London, Stanford, and at Lawrence Livermore Labs in Berkeley. His most recent book is The Systems View of Life, A Unifying Vision, and it's perhaps the most comprehensive textbook to understanding how the emerging discipline of systems theory can inform and recreate our perceptions and actions and just about everything in our lives. His website is fritjofcapra.net. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you for having me on your show again, and thank you for this very nice introduction.
Well, I'm sure that we're going to have you ignite some new thoughts within our consciousness. And during the past decade, there has emerged a discipline that still remains relatively unknown in the mainstream public, which is to look at life and biology and communities, just about everything, from what is called a systems perspective. And as with all new paradigms, it requires a shift of orientation, a stepping away from the older patterns of thinking in order to be open to new vantage points for observing something with fresh eyes and new perspective. And throughout your career, particularly starting in the 1970s, you've witnessed a clash between what we can call linear rationalistic thought and the models and structures it creates in the sciences, religion, society, and an alternative vision that is integral, holistic, and recognizes interrelationships between otherwise disparate elements. Now, this is a major focus of systems theory and developing a new vision for understanding ourselves, the world around us, the environment, the ecology, and how our cultures and societies are structured and function. So please begin with providing a broad general overview to what a systems theory perspective is and how does it differ from conventional day-to-day thinking upon which our dominant corporate scientific disciplines and social institutions are built.
All right. Well, let me just go to the very heart of the matter, the change of paradigms, the change of worldviews that has been happening over the last three decades in science and also in society, is at its very core a fundamental change of metaphors, a change from seeing the world as a machine to understanding it as a network. Now, everybody today knows about social networks, social media, and so on, the internet, especially our youth, the young people, live in these social networks. But networks have a much broader significance than that. They are also present in biology. Every living system, every living organism is organized as a network. And in ecology, ecosystems are understood as food webs, that is, networks of organisms. So we are talking here about a very profound change. We have discovered that the material world is ultimately a network of inseparable patterns of relationships. We have also discovered that the planet as a whole is a living, self-regulating system, a global biological network. Accordingly, the view of the human body as a machine and of the mind as a separate entity is now being replaced by one that sees not only the brain, but also the immune system, the bodily tissues, and even each cell as a living cognitive system. Then evolution, there has been a major change there too that I discuss in my book. Evolution is no longer seen as a competitive struggle for existence, but rather as a cooperative dance in which creativity and the constant emergence of novelty are the driving forces. And with the new emphasis on complexity, patterns of organization, networks, a new science of qualities is now slowly emerging. Now, I have followed this emergence of this new science of quality for the last 30 years, and I've tried to construct a coherent conceptual framework over the years and published it in various books such as The Web of Life in 1996, The Hidden Connections in 2002, I think it was. And now in my last book, The Systems View of Life, which, by the way, I co-authored with a biochemist in Rome, Pierluigi Luisi, this book is really a grand synthesis of this conceptual framework that integrates four dimensions of life: the biological dimension, the cognitive dimension, the social, and the ecological dimension. So for me, this is really a culmination of 30 years of work.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you. Scientists frequently argue that pure science is only concerned with facts that are evidence-based, and therefore are basically amoral or shouldn't concern subjective values and ethics. I regard this as a very determinist and reductionist way of looking at science. How does a systems view of ourselves and the world, therefore, introduce values and morals and ethics into what is otherwise regarded as amoral? And how and why do human values actually arise in a systems view of life?
Well, the systems view of life shows us that we are not isolated individuals, but we are always embedded in communities. In fact, one of the key characteristics of life is that living beings form communities. From the very origin of life on Earth, more than 3 billion years ago, the first living organisms, the first bacteria, formed communities known as bacterial colonies, and throughout evolution, at every stage, living species, living organisms formed communities. Ecosystems are communities of plants, animals, and microorganisms embedded in a non-living natural environment that gives them the resources. And so as human beings, we're also embedded in various communities. We are obviously embedded in our communities, our families, our professional associations, our countries, but also together with all other living beings in ecosystems and ultimately in the biosphere. Now, when you talk about ethics, ethics is usually, as you indicated, associated with religion and or with philosophy. But there's a much more general view of ethics, which simply says ethical behavior is behavior for the common good. We behave ethically when we behave on behalf of the communities we belong to. And although we all belong to many different communities, we all share two communities that we belong to. We all belong to humanity, and we belong to the biosphere, the community of living organisms on Earth. And so when you belong to a community, you behave accordingly. Ethical behavior is behavior for the common good. And as members of humanity, we have to respect basic human dignity. And as members of the biosphere, we have to respect how nature sustains life. In other words, ecological sustainability. So for me, those are the two key values that the systems view of life leads us to, human dignity and ethic and ecological sustainability.
Now, since systems theory can apply to numerous subjects, as you just mentioned, biology, genetics, evolution, the interface between science and religion, cosmology, macroeconomics, how we structure organizations, including government and healthcare and so much more, I understand that we have to look even at modern agriculture as practiced today and the environment and climate change and ecology as an example of how systems theories operate. For example, how can systems theory inform us about the dangers of modern agriculture as well as point and guide us towards solutions? So take your time and share how a systems approach can be applied to chemical industrial agriculture and how it will affect our entire planet and civilization and why, and also the relationship between industrial agriculture and global warming, and another important factor we need to be looking at in this integral system view, and that is greed and emotional imbalance in those who head these systems. Because if you don't look at the person heading a system, then a good system by theory may become a perverse system by application.
Right. Well, that's a big package, Gary, that you are putting on the table. Well, let me start with the very fundamental insight that is now becoming more and more evident, and that is that the major problems of our time, energy, environment, climate change, poverty, and so on, cannot be understood in isolation. None of these problems can be solved in isolation. They all hang together. They're all interconnected and interdependent. And this is what in science we call systemic. So they are systemic problems, problems of the system as a whole. And being systemic problems, they need systemic solutions. A systemic solution is a solution that does not solve any problem in isolation, but always within the context of other problems. And therefore, typically, a systemic solution will solve several problems at the same time. And I'm very glad that you brought up agriculture, because for me, agriculture is a prime example of a systemic solution. So let's just see why. If we changed from our chemical large-scale industrial agriculture, which is the majority of agriculture today, to organic, community-oriented, sustainable farming, this would contribute significantly to solving three of our biggest problems. First, it would greatly reduce our energy dependence, because we are now using one-fifth of our fossil fuels to grow and process food. Secondly, the healthy, organically grown food would have a huge positive effect on public health, and I'm sure you talk a lot about this on your show, because many chronic diseases, heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and so on, are linked directly to our diet. And third, and this is not so well known, organic farming would contribute significantly to fighting climate change. Why? Because an organic soil is a carbon-rich soil. It's a living soil, and carbon is the chemical backbone of life. So where does it get the carbon from? Well, from the atmosphere. An organic soil continually draws down CO2 from the atmosphere. And it has been estimated that if we changed to organic agriculture, or as it is now also called, regenerative agriculture, this would help to completely stabilize the climate within a few years. So this is a typical example of a systemic solution that solves several problems. The basic problem is no longer in conceptual or in the technologies, but rather in the mind and in the ethics of our political and corporate leaders, as you indicated.
Thank you. I appreciate how you brought that together. It makes a lot of sense. I'd like to return to an older topic that you've been involved with for, I know, at least 40 years, and that is the dialogue between science and religion. And why this is so important right now is because over the past 10 to 15, 20 years, we've been witnessing in mainstream society and swings towards literalist, fundamentalist religion that is specifically anti-science or based upon misinformed science, such as denying climate change or believing the universe is only 6,000 years old and Noah had dinosaurs on the ark. And
moreover,
and by the way, 80% of the presidential candidates on the Republican side say they believe this, including including the neurosurgeon, which is really a disappointment. But on the flip side, there is the emergence of science as a religion and based upon extreme atheistic views that hate religion and spirituality in any shape and form. And I remember your early work in the Tao of Physics in the Turning Point, however, and I would like to hear how your views have changed or new insights you have on the interface between science and spirituality. And the second, how can a systems orientation heal this sharp divide between scientism and extreme anti-science religion?
Mm-hmm. Well, my views have not changed, but have evolved. And in fact, in our book, The Systems View of Life, we have a whole chapter on science and spirituality. And I think a large part of the problem arises from the fact that people confuse spirituality and religion. And in the book, we explain this in detail, and this is the major point of our chapter. Spirituality has to do with a special kind of experience that makes us feel connected to a larger whole, makes us feel embedded in a larger whole. There's a kind of a sense of belonging to the universe that is characteristic of a spiritual experience. It is also sometimes called a mystical experience because of the encounter with mystery, the realization that ultimately we can't explain everything. There are always boundaries to our knowledge. Another way of approaching this is through the very word spirit, which from the Latin spiritus means breath, and means the breath of life. So our spiritual moments are the moments when we are most intensely alive. And those are moments when, the distinction between mind and body disappears, and the distinction between the self and the environment, and we sort of merge into, in somehow mysterious way, into a larger whole. Now, this spiritual or mystical experience has been described throughout the ages in all cultures of the world and in all times, and it has some these basic characteristics that I just described in common wherever it appears. Now, religion is the organized attempt of explaining spiritual experience, of using it to form a religious community and a certain sense of ethics that goes with this community. And this is all very good and well, but what often happened in religions is that the core of the religion, the spiritual experience, was forgotten, and people concentrated then on the interpretations, on dogmas, and of course also on having power by having, you know, a large community of followers. So I think when we talk about spirituality, we can find a great harmony between science in general and the systems view of life in particular and spiritual experience. Because the systems view of life shows us in detail how we are embedded in nature, how we belong to a larger whole. I mean, every part of my body, every molecule is shared with other living beings. The same kinds of molecules, the proteins, the enzymes, and so on, are present throughout life. The same metabolic patterns can be observed in all living beings. And all, of course, when we die, the molecules do not die, but are passed on into the environment and will live on because life lives on. So all this is, you know, the system's view of life, but it's also spiritual insight. So there's complete harmony. We're not thrown into chaos, into a big machine, but we are part of a big symphony of life. And so this is a very beautiful and very, very positive insight. It's only when religion becomes dogmatic, and I should say also when science becomes dogmatic, that these clashes occur.
I believe also that when individuals become dogmatic, and I think you've made a major contribution. I'm really impressed with the systems view of life, a unifying vision. My guest, Fritjof Capra, you can go to fritjofcapra.net and get more information. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Gary. It was a great pleasure.
The Conversation with the Remarkable Minds, Fritjof Capra. We're going to close today's program with some statements from Martin Luther King, different ones at different times, that most people are not familiar with. And then think, when you hear these, how would this change the world if we actually live by these principles today?
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists.
Estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam. while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor.
The promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home.
The other thing I want you to understand is this, that it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counters.
Well,
it didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power.
Yes, yes.
All labor has dignity.
Yes.
But you are doing another thing. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. And the question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will. At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. And this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check. I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with a pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. As somebody said earlier tonight, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language
They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure, high, and clean. But I want to get the language right tonight.
Imagine if we had those talks today, but we don't have the leaders who have the spiritual or intellectual capacity, nor the political will to exercise any of his statements. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.